Hello, everyone. Welcome to Parkside Today. I'm Oliver Johnson, and it's a pleasure to be talking with UW-Parkside Professor Jay McCroy about the new film and cultural studies concentration that launched this semester in the English major. Jay began his UW-Parkside career in the Department of English in 2001, where his courses cover an array of topics in film and literary analysis, and where he quickly became a favorite among students in the major and those fortunate enough to become students in his gen ed courses. Jay was the recipient of the coveted Stella C. Gray Teaching Excellence Award in 2017. He developed the Film Studies Certificate Program and, not surprisingly, is passionate about film. His interests include watching movies, making movies, and writing about movies. Jay is the author of Nightmare Japan, Contemporary Japanese Horror Cinema, and, because Halloween is fast approaching, we'll pick his brain to learn what his favorite horror films are and what he loves about the genre. And Jay, welcome to the program.
Hey, it's great to be here.
So when did your love of film and literary analysis begin?
Well, I guess if I had to look for an initial moment, it would be when I was, 11 or 12 years old, I would say. The film appreciation of film and literature sort of happened kind of simultaneously. I was kind of a latchkey kid, so my parents were not home a lot. They had to work a bunch of jobs, and my brother and I were sort of left on our own. And, of course, this was in the very early days of cable, so suddenly I was introduced to a world of motion pictures that I really didn't know existed, and because my parents were really lax about any kind of parental controls over what it was that I was watching, since they were never really around, it was easy for me to see an array of films and to see movies that when I watched them, even at a young age, like 11, 12, I realized that there was something going on in these works that was just not happening in the kinds of films that up until around age 11 or 12 and my exposure via cable to an entire world of cinema that I didn't know existed, it was really eye-opening. And it was around that time that I also got into reading, in part because of not really having been taught to read all that well prior to middle school, and then spending so much time in detention that I basically ended up, learning how to read kind of because I had to kill 2 hours at the end of every day before I could go home. So, but it was ultimately a valuable, worthwhile experience, and I made it a mission to try to read as much as I could to sort of make up for deficiencies that I felt kind of self-conscious about, to be honest. Okay. Yeah.
So the film and cultural studies concentration is offered in the English major, just launched there this semester. Tell us a little bit about the new concentration and what its connection is to the English discipline.
Oh, that's a great question. Actually, we're really excited about this new concentration. It is building off of, in some ways, work that the English department has been doing all along, sure, which is cultural studies, et cetera. And, of course, the film study certificate, which is still an active certificate program on campus, very, very popular one. It seemed only natural to begin moving in this direction, hoping to draw in students who are interested not just in literature, but also in terms of the intersection between literature and culture, between culture and cinema, between literature and cinema, and start to be able to create a program that would allow for a very expansive understanding of media, whether it be film or literary studies. And, of course, I think that allows students also to sharpen research skills, sure, critical writing skills, communication skills, the ability to articulate and defend opinions, the ability to develop ideas to outcomes. And these are all obviously very transferable skills to the workplace, which is, I think, an important element of this new concentration as well.
Right, right. And we'll talk more about the concentration. I want to get you started at least on some of your top films.
Oh, yes.
I know it might be difficult to put them in any particular order, so maybe we'll scrap that idea. But let's just hear some titles of some of your top horror films. And I know you have a specific interest in a sort of a subgenre of horror, if I'm remembering correctly. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So what are some of those films? Just a few of them for now.
Well, as I was making this list, I tried to think back to, because, you know, try to think back to what were the ones that really scared me when I was young,
okay,
right? So
okay.
Many of these films are sort of clumped around certain time periods. I found myself sort of making my list. Was it that the person in the book High Fidelity says he makes his list of and mixtapes and lists of albums and that kind of thing autobiographically,
sure, yeah,
rather than alphabetically or anything like that. So I kind of do that. So some movies that when I was young particularly freaked me out. Nosferatu, the F.W. Murnau,
sure,
classic German expressionist silent film. It holds up. I mean, I still teach it in my History of Film to 1950s classes, and I think it holds up really, really, really well. There's just something very uncanny, something very creepy about Max Schreck's performance as Nosferatu. And it's I remember seeing just tiny excerpts from this film before I actually saw the movie itself, and being sort of terrified just by the, you know, these random images of this gaunt, almost rat-like creature. And, you know, as I eventually had the opportunity to see the entire film, it became a favorite of mine. As is, by the way, the remake by Werner Herzog from 1979. That's another really, really, really great film. I also was very much into when I was getting into horror films, again, around the age of 12 or so, John Carpenter's The Thing, that sort of blew me away, particularly now when I look back at it in terms of the quality of the practical effects that they used to create the horrific images in that film. I mean, very, very powerful. The Exorcist and Rosemary's Baby as well.
Yeah,
both
yeah.
of those were real important to me very early in my film viewing education, but also in terms of horror cinema, certainly stood out to me. And in The Exorcist, for instance, and even a movie like Rosemary's Baby or The Shining, Kubrick's Shining, I mean, these were films that I felt were doing something more. You know, even if I couldn't at that age put my finger on exactly what it was, there was something beyond the horror element that was really exciting to me. And I remember actually now, looking back, I wish I had had the advice of the Slovenian philosopher Slavoj Žižek, who in his film Pervert's Guide to Cinema actually argues that if one wants to know what a horror film is really about, to imagine the same scenario but with the horror element removed, right? So The Shining becomes, you know, not this story about a haunted hotel, but rather the story about a disintegrating family,
mm-hmm.
you know, trapped together in isolation. So, I mean, it's those kinds of, and I think those are the kinds of through lines and themes and motifs that I was picking up on, even if I was not old enough or didn't have the vocabulary to be able to articulate exactly what it was that I was keying into.
Right. Some critical titles here, and we will return to this topic to hear some more titles. I just want to say, for those listeners who haven't seen some of these films on the big screen,
for sure,
keep an eye out for, you know, those random showings in film festivals or in art house cinemas, that if you can get the chance. I mean, streaming is one thing, but seeing it on the large screen is an experience like none other.
Oh, yeah, and if you take my classes, you'll be able to see things on the big screen.
Awesome.
So that's
awesome.
Something that everyone should do.
Oh, great.
Everyone.
Great lead into this next question, Jay. What kinds of learning opportunities inside and outside the classroom are students going to gain from this concentration?
Well, one of the things I think that's most important is to look at literary, cinematic, and pop culture texts critically and seriously. I think that being familiarizing oneself, I guess, with these particular texts is already like one of the most valuable things that happens in the classroom. So just being made aware that certain texts exist, and then to begin to look at them critically to see what sort of ideas or ideologies are being promoted or being challenged. So that's, I think, an important element right there. Certainly in terms of cinema studies, which is my particular area of interest, I would say that the most important thing that students can do is to watch films and to watch as many films as possible and to watch them with a critical eye so that when you encounter a scene, right, that moves you emotionally, to look at what's happening visually, to look at what's happening in terms of the soundtrack and to listen for certain sound cues and the relationship between sound and image. I think as the more you look at that, the more you see how constructed our media is. And the more able you are to recognize these constructions, the more able you are to consume these modes of media intelligently, and be able to see how people can use image and sound to manipulate, which is what filmmakers do all the time and what we pay them big money to do, which is to manipulate us, to take us into another world so that we can dream together in the dark of the theater. And that's one of the things I think is important about this particular major, and something that can happen inside the classroom, absolutely, as well as the ability to start making one's own movies, right, to have access to the equipment. And we just bought a ton of equipment here at the school for students, and I can't wait. I'm going to be teaching next semester. I'll be teaching a class in digital video.
Awesome.
Yeah,
awesome.
It's going to be fun, where students will just be making movies nonstop. You know, I give them little assignments, go out with the camera, take this, you know, give me, you know, 10 shots, no shot can be more than 20 seconds. The camera can only move in one of those shots, and it can't be the last one. Go. You know, bring me back something interesting. Bring me back something gnarly. Show me something that I hadn't seen before, right? Talk about story, the construction of story. Talk about composition in terms of framing. It really opens up a lot of elements. And, of course, then students can take that experience out into the world with them. At Parkside, I've been lucky in particular over the last two decades to have encountered so many really smart, really creative students that have gone on to make films and to create little film collectives of their own. I mean, it's been really a pleasure. And now I think this is only going to increase the more students that we're able to introduce to digital video and film production and you know, the analysis of cinema and popular culture. The more we're able to reach, I think it's going to be very exciting. I think there's great, great things ahead for this program.
Awesome. What about after? What about after graduation? What is this going to do for students? Where does it take them? You mentioned some students, now alum,
mm-hmm.
that are already making film. This adds a new layer of critical skills. What do you see for students that are graduating from this program?
Well, the skill set that we are going to try to promote is one that opens up the possibilities for a number of different career paths. Now, I have a list of here on the promotional materials, so sure. If you allow me to read something from the propaganda that we have. basically what we did on one of the flyers that we made was to create just in anticipation of these kind of questions, a list of careers that film studies majors in traditionally have found employment in. Of course, these are not the only jobs that one could use these skills for. I mean, you can use these skills for many, 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 many career paths. But just to give you a sense of the diversity, I'll just go ahead and read a few right off the promotional materials. Obviously, writer, editor, writer, producer, writer, director, you know, whether it be for film, television, video, the internet, et cetera. Obviously, creative content writing is always necessary, is always needed. Content writing in general is always needed, but particularly for video games, for blogs, for vlogs, film and television production. We're looking at jobs in, as journalist, grant writer, film and video director, art media journalist, media and film critic, press and media agent, communication arts worker, freelance writer, editor, corporate videographer, web content manager, social media manager. I mean, there's just so many different career paths that these skills are transferable to that it's really it's really I think an exciting time for students, particularly if they, you know, are interested in these fields. Now there is a concentration within an academic major that allows for the development of these skills and allows for them to be able to take that skill set and, you know, transfer that into life outside of the university, life after Parkside, which there is, by the way, life after right. Parkside, a very exciting life after Parkside. Though, obviously, I'm one of these people who loves the warm, soft womb of academia and has found a way to stay here. But it is an exciting world out there, and there's a lot of possibilities. I mean, really, visual media is the primary way that we communicate. I mean, whether it be Facebook or, Tinseltown. I mean, it's really the rhetoric of the 20th, 21st century is a right. visual one. Right. And so understanding, again, how that rhetoric works and being able to apply it allows you to really opens you up to a lot of different fields and a lot of different career possibilities.
Right. I mean, you really can't go a day without consuming some sort of media that's driven in a graphic way. I mean, now probably more than ever, we're just really obsessed with and hungry for content. And I think you're right. Now is the time to really equip these students with the skills necessary. I mean, they're kind of doing it on their own, mm-hmm. but what a program like this does is puts the thought behind some of what the work is going to become, or, you know, it can be referential in the best way possible to a whole, you know, decade of film that they learn about that maybe they wouldn't have been exposed to otherwise. Exciting time for Parkside students.
And for visual media in general. I mean, it's continuing to develop and expand in new ways. And, you know, one of the things that I'm excited about the possibility of teaching as well is sort of looking at video games and the content of video games right. in relation to, because there's a very cinematic mode of media. So that's something that I think a lot of students are interested in, and it sort of crosses over between literature, storytelling, you know, narrative development, and visual culture.
Yeah,
you know, whether it's a first-person shooter, which is just mise-en-scène constantly, or whether it's something, you know, different, like a third-person or whatever, where you have, like, a story and you have more conventional montage editing.
Right, right. And how brilliant for students to be able to tell their parents or other influencers,
yeah,
know, yeah, this is a major. Studying this is real. This is, I mean, these are career paths. This might be a pastime. You know, video games may be one thing to a certain generation, but it's, I mean, it is like this new form of long form media storytelling that, you know, it doesn't just happen, right?
If you ever play to the end of the games, which I try to finish every game I start, doesn't always happen. It doesn't happen with films either. But, when you ever get to the end and you see the credits, right, there's you know, tons of people working, not just in terms of the graphics, but also in terms of the story development, and that kind of thing. Absolutely. And that way you could also, you know, take a class, play video games all night, and then if somebody criticizes you, you could just tell them you're doing your homework, which is true. So that's good. I mean, I remember thinking, you know, it'd be great to put in a grant for a really huge TV, you know, an Xbox, a power gaming PC. And it feels almost obscene, but it's like, yeah, I mean, that would be perfectly logical prep materials and necessary prep materials, obviously. And it is a long form format video games, which is an exciting element as well, and will entail a lot of homework. So,
switching gears back to this list of, in no particular order, top films from Jay McCroy. What else do you have on your list?
Oh, okay. Let me look at another group is some films that I've seen recently that I've really enjoyed. Some are obvious. Like, I really like Midsommar a lot, actually. I thought that film was quite good. But two recent films that I've really enjoyed. One is A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night by Anna Lily Amirpour, an Iranian filmmaker. This is a vampire story. It's shot in black and white, and it's shot in a widescreen aspect ratio, and it has the feel, for me at least, of early 70s Japanese Sun Tribe films, or 60s films as well. That's pretty exciting. But it also has a feel of sort of like, I guess, Tarantino-esque kind of heightened tensions and action sequences. And so that's a great film. Another film, a very, very different film, would be Julia Ducournau's Raw, which is a cannibal film that takes place at a med school. I don't want to say too much because the film has a very sort of slight narrative, but it's also extremely unsettling.
Yeah.
So I recommend it highly. I should probably mention a couple of Japanese films that I really, really enjoy. One is 1977's House, which is, I don't know how to describe this film. It's ultimately a haunted house film, but some of the strangest visuals that I've ever seen in a film, some of the strangest imagery that I've ever seen, an amazing work. And Juon, the whole Grudge series, but particularly the television and cinema of Takashi Shimizu, great stuff, good stuff. I really like the Juon films a lot. I like what it does with narrative. I like how it fragments the story. I like how how the familiar, the home environment becomes a place of radical strangeness. I think House and Juon both do that. So
now, are these films that you just referenced, will these appear in your next book, titled Gothic Studies? Gothic Film.
Gothic Film. It's we just are going to press with that starting Monday. So I'm very, very excited about that. Gothic Film, there is a chapter on vampires in Asian horror in the volume, but there isn't a chapter on Japanese cinema, you know, on its own. I wrote a chapter for it on film noir and the Gothic. And in that, I look at Alfred Hitchcock's Shadow of a Doubt and Park Chan-wook's Stoker, and I look at those. It's a Korean film, and I look at those two movies together in the light of film noir aesthetics and Gothic motifs. But it's a collection of essays by some of the premier names in the field, and so I'm really excited about that. It's published through Edinburgh University Press. And it's part of the Edinburgh Studies in the Gothic series. So we're me and my co-editor and I are really, really excited.
Awesome.
Yeah. I almost said me and my co-editor. That's terrible. Me is excited.
Me is excited, yeah. What can we expect from the film industry, the film, the media, the literary? Don't want to leave that part of your world out. In the next few years, any predictions for shifts or trends to keep an eye out for?
That's a great question. I'm curious to see how long they can milk the comic book thing.
Oh yeah,
it's sort of interesting to see what happens there, especially since right now there's sort of meme wars going on and comments flying back and forth between filmmakers about the. You know, whether Marvel cinema constitutes cinema at all, or whether, you know, that they're just amusement park rides, to quote Martin Scorsese. And so right now, it'd be interesting to see where that goes. I'm always interested in seeing how genres develop and change over time. And that's certainly one that I'm interested in seeing what happens there. I'm also sort of curious to see what happens in terms of experimental film and what new avenues experimental filmmakers push their works into. There's a great movie that I just saw recently called Sleep Has Her House by the filmmaker Scott Barley, and it's a brilliant work. It's just insanely beautiful. It's this dark landscape film that I mean, to try to limit it by describing it is really a crime. But it's dark landscapes, heavily processed images, and it becomes much more metaphysical than material at times. It's a brilliant movie.
Where do you stand on the idea that this fast paced kind of instant gratification form of media is seeping into the film industry? Have you tapped into this dialogue around that, and have you witnessed this? Or are there things that are concerning to you? Or
by the fast paced, do you mean sort of like in terms of the editing, or?
Well, you know, in some of it, it's not quite the editing. It's the idea that, you know, you can film something, you know, while you're in line and get it uploaded on the internet, suddenly become, you know, today's filmmaker of a sense.
Yes,
And what does that do to the film industry and long form?
It's a good question. I think in long form, one of the things that they could do is to embrace and maybe experiment with some of the that speed that you're talking about, with the idea of sort of amateur video shot on the spot, right? And of course, they kind of have done that recently with, you know, all these found footage films.
Oh,
you know,
sure.
And horror films are often found footage. Horror films are often cited as some of the more entertaining, you know, because I think there is that connection between sort of the, you know, the experience a lot of people have of just whipping out their phones and what happens when you do that in an environment where something, you know, where a haunting is taking place or something along those lines. But I think that one of the things that that cinema can do is to start to incorporate some of these aesthetics. So GIF aesthetics, for instance, or looping of images. This is where I think experimental film can sort of lead the way, as it often always does lead the way, right? So I think that it'd be interesting to see how film can incorporate that first, I think, in terms of experimental avant-garde film, but then obviously in terms of, you know, long-form narrative films as well.
So you said something I've never heard before. You said the GIF
aesthetic? Yes. Yes.
5 years ago, wow. Probably. Not even 5 years ago.
Probably. That probably wouldn't have been a thing. Yes. And now I'm thinking these tiny little 15-second loops or what have you. Yeah,
the TikTok. Yeah,
recycled images, you know, reused in new forms. I mean, because why, you know, sometimes I think to myself, you know, why shoot anything new in the first place when we have so many images that are just going, you know, they're just disappearing. You know, recycle them, man. You don't need to shoot that whale again. You have a footage of a whale. You know, you've got that. Huh. You know, do something cool with that footage.
Yeah.
Treat it like one tray of watercolor in a watercolor set, right? And you have this image that already exists, and now you can start to process it. And that's one of the things I find fascinating about video and digital video for myself is the elasticity of the format, right? You can do a lot with images to, I mean, it's like you set up the shot, you get the lighting just right, you have everything the way you want it, you shoot in the highest resolution possible, and then, you know, now you have one crayon from a box that you can then mix with other things to create something. You know, that's one of the things I want from long-form media is to start showing me things I haven't seen before instead of recycling the same narratives again and again. But, of course, it's an industry, and it's run on cash, and it's run on money. So there's, this, you know, obviously an incentive to recycle the certain narratives again and again and again, which is why we'll get the Halloween franchise rebooted for the upcoming time.
Reboot. Yeah. You got anything left on your list?
On my list? Let's see, what else is left here? Okay, a couple from the 50s, 60s that as I was in film school and I saw really excited me. One was Robert Wise's The Haunting from 1963. It's been remade, stay away from that, but the 1963 version is particularly terrifying. I mean, I remember when I was a kid being terrified just by the screen goes black and you just hear sounds and breathing in the background. I mean, this is something that gets recycled in horror films all the time. But this was the first time that I had seen it, and it's, I think, one of the first times that it's used. And it terrified me that I could be And excited me that I could be afraid of basically nothing, a black screen, right? But which is then filled with all the projections that I have inside of what it is that's happening there. And Georges Franju's film, a surrealist film called Eyes Without a Face, about a doctor whose daughter gets into a automobile accident and is badly disfigured. Her face is completely burned, and he is luring women to his house, his estate, to remove their faces and transplant them onto his daughter, and then they don't take and they start to rot off. And it's good stuff, though. I mean, it sounds gory and gruesome, and there's some gory, gruesome scenes for in the film, but it's far more subtle than you would imagine. It's actually quite beautiful. The imagery is beautiful. The lighting is beautiful.
Like it's,
well, I mean, I also think that I'm looking forward to the The Lighthouse that's coming out. I'm trying to think of the name of the film right now. With Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe, looks really, really, really great. So hopefully that'll open soon. It's supposed to have opened on Thursday, but then I went online to IMDb, looked around, and it's not playing anywhere close to here, so I'm thinking it's probably going to open wider next week. So.
Oh, okay. And that one may make its way onto your list then.
Well, probably.
We'll see.
Who knows?
We'll see.
It's an exclusive list. It's the list I came up with on my way here.
Awesome. And we will do our best to recap Jay's list and post that where this interview will live on the web. And for those listeners who are interested in diving in and finding the films in the way that they do. So this is probably the worst question.
The one I've been dreading. Yes.
Yeah. So top film, is it possible? Do you have a favorite?
It's not possible, but it's not possible. Though there are certain filmmakers that I see myself returning to again and again and again. And that's probably the easiest way to do it.
Yep.
Filmmakers who I really, really admire, Andrei Tarkovsky, the Russian filmmaker, particularly his poetic pieces, amazing cinema. Robert Bresson, the French filmmaker, his works, Mouchette, Alhazard, Balthazar, Pickpocket, Devil Probably, just essential texts for me. I also very much admire the work of Chantal Ackerman quite a lot, Jean Dielman, and she's able to range between gallery pieces to video pieces in galleries to feature length films to short films, narrative, documentary. I mean, just great stuff. And in terms of my favorite book, probably Naked Lunch, William S. Burroughs.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the novel I probably read the most in my life. It's a book that I return to every now and then. I just think it's hilarious. It's very funny.
And was that when did you read that book for the first time?
For the first time in probably eighth grade, which
really?
Was way
okay.
too young. You know, I thought it was cool. It's like, oh, this dude does heroin. It's cool. Like an eighth grader might.
Yeah.
well, maybe not all eighth graders. Maybe I was special in that case. But I remember being like really drawn to the beat writers, like Kerouac as well. But that was my initial interest in Burroughs was probably just, who is this guy? I've heard, I see his face all over the place. I hear his name all over the place. I hear this book referenced. But at in eighth grade, ninth grade, way too young to get it. Way too young to understand it.
Well,
way too young.
Not far off from the first time I read it. It was sophomore year in high school. And it was in English class, but it wasn't.
Really?
It was not.
That's a cool English
no,
class.
No, 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 no. It was not the teacher. It was a friend of mine who just said, hey, she brought it with her one day, and she said, hey, you should read this book.
Wow.
We had kind of gotten used to each other.
That's
and
awesome.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it was an English class, but it was not on the list of suggested
reading.
You know
where I found my
reading.
Copy? My copy I found in a used bookstore In Fall River, Massachusetts, which is, you don't expect to find bookstores in Fall River, Massachusetts. In fact, they've done away with them now because it's just the way that town is. But I remember, though, going into the store and seeing it on the shelf and being like, Naked Lunch. And there was this older guy who was working behind the counter. He's like, you like the Naked Lunch, do you? I'm like, well, I don't know. I've heard good things about it. You know, should I read it? He's like, yeah, it's interesting. Interesting as hell. And I'm like, okay, well, in a way it is, actually, now that I look back at it. So I remember picking it up from that store, and it was a old battered paperback version, sort of, you know, dark black cover with lurid red, like neon-like font that said Naked Lunch on it. And I remember the pages of the book were lined in red. That was kind of cool. And
still have it?
Do I still have it? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Nice. It's at my house. It's still falling apart. It's sort of wrapped up in cellophane to hold it together. I've probably gone through 4 different editions of that book. And, you know, because I teach it occasionally, because I used it in my dissertation. I wrote essays about it in undergrad and in grad school. I probably have revisited that book a number of times. And so obviously they wear out.
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
And
yeah.
I'm a big fan of wearing out your books. I think that books that, you know, that people are very careful with, they don't crack the spines or anything like that. There's not a real relationship with the book. I think the relationship between a person and their book should be a physical, visceral, material thing. You know, we should engage in a kind of critical dialogue with the writer right there on the side of the page,
right,
which is how
notes
I do it.
Notes in the margin.
Yeah, underlining. And it should be, they should be able to read an experience through your marginalia.
Yeah.
You know?
And then you donate the book and hope that somebody finds it in the nearest bookstore.
Yeah. I love going to thrift stores and finding people's notes in their books. It's great.
Yeah.
You can see how they – it's kind of almost like a roadmap to how they experience that particular work. It's fantastic to do that. And I also love finding pieces of, like, found art, like photographs and stuff inside of old books. So sometimes I'll go to, like, you know, St. Vincent de Paul or Goodwill or whatever and just flip through the books looking for old photos that people leave in there because they're very, very strange.
Or inside front cover, the little note from so-and-so's grandma or aunt or neighbor.
Yes, 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 yes. Dear Jay, here's another copy of Naked Lunch. Please enjoy. Love, Grandma.
We noticed yours is seeing better days.
Yours is falling apart.
Jay, thank you for coming on the show.
Oh,
it was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
Loved hearing about your interests and your insight into the industry and of course, about the film and cultural studies concentration here at UW Parkside.
Absolutely. And if anyone wants any more information about that, they can email me at mcroy@uwp.edu, and I'd be happy to get you any materials you might need.
Awesome.
Or they can just drop by my office. Anyone can just drop by my office. I'm pretty friendly. I don't bite. It's, there's toys that you can play with. It's fun.
Like I said, we'll do our best to recap some of Jay's list. We'll make sure that students can find your contact information in your office to learn more about the program. To hear past editions of Parkside Today, visit uwp.edu/Parkside Today. Thanks for listening.